on air on Fan for Racing Radio. This is Monday night, April the 22nd, and we are here for our Talladega NASCAR race review and Hot Topics sound off. Sal Segala, the co-host, will be joining us shortly, but we're going to start with our short track news and an ARCA East update. Afterward, we're going to review the ARCA Menards Series race at Talladega and then the ARCA West Series race at Kevin Harvick's Kern Raceway. Both races were on Saturday, and there's a lot to talk about there. In the next half hour, we are going to update the NASCAR Truck Series and then review the NASCAR Xfinity Series and the NASCAR Cup Series races at Talladega Super Speedway. And as we do every episode, we're going to end the show tonight with our Hot Topic sound-off conversation with the Fan for Racing crew. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to split my screen here so that I can keep an eye on when Sal shows up, but let me go ahead and get into our show here for tonight with the news from the short track scene. So I'm going to start with the Dirt Series, the World of Outlaw Sprint Cars. All is right in the world when Haughton Schell rips the top. Sheldon Haughton Schell did not just notch a victory at Paducah International Raceway, and you can read about it at worldofoutlaws.com. Alex Knighton writes that story. Also, Brady Bacon is an expert at Tri-State Speedway. Bacon hustled around Hopstat and beat David Gravel to score an outlaw win in Indiana this weekend. Alex Knighton again writes about that at World of Outlaws. Let's talk about some high limit racing. It took him a while, but that big cat finally broke through at Southern Oklahoma Speedway. Brad Sweet scored his first victory in 10 high limit racing starts. So good to see Brad Sweet back in victory lane. Also, scoring the second win didn't take nearly as long. Sweet swept the Tour's race weekend, claiming a Saturday victory at Salina High Bank Speedway. And both of those stories are at highlimitracing.com. Now let's talk about the World of Outlaws late models. Across the street from NASCAR's race weekend, the Outlaws saw Dylan Knowles and Max McLaughlin score preliminary victories at the Talladega Short Track. And also, rain actually scuppered the rest of the weekend, postponing the remainder of the Alabama Gang 102 September. So both of those stories are also at worldofoutlaws.com, and they are written by Matt Skipper. Moving on to USAC, welcome back to Silver Crown. Cody Swanson, 4 months after sustaining severely broken left foot, Swanson returned with a dominant victory at Toledo Speedway, and Richie Murray writes about that over at USAC Media. In the American Sprint Car Series, we've got Seth Bergman picking up a victory at the Tour's opener at Super B Speedway. That story is over at ASCSRacing.com. And rain ruled out the rest of the weekend, forcing another cancellation of Saturday's race. You can read all about it at the ASCSRacing.com. And our last story on this series, Bobby Pierce has his swagger back. Pierce is already up to 10 wins this year and hunting for more. Kyle McFadden writes about that over at Flow Racing. All right, joining me now is our co-host for tonight, that is Sal Segala. Welcome to the show, Sal.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Okay, I was just getting ready to get into the short tracks part of the episode here. I don't know if you've got everything pulled up yet. Would you be ready to do that, or do you want me to continue on?
Oh, no, I got it up. I got it up, yeah.
Okay. It starts with the Cars Tour.
So, yeah, the Cars Tour, you got Kevin Harvick Incorporated returned to the winner's circle with one of the stock car racing's brightest young prospects, Brett Cruz, picked up his first partial win at Orange County Speedway. Matt Weaver has that story at Short Track Seat.
Okay, and things ended up going okay, but the track pavement was a concern entering Saturday. Matt Weaver again writes about that at Short Track Scene. And we've got a couple of other stories at Short Track Scene, Sal.
Yeah, we got the Hayes George 200 in Bowman Gray Stadium's return to action. Burt Myers notched his 11th victory in the 100-lap race.
And then at South Boston Speedway, Kyle Dudley prevailed in Saturday's 100-lap late model stock car feature for his first win at the track. That story also at Short Track Scene.
And then
a NASCAR name.
Yeah, and then from there, then we go to Kyle Busch is coming back to the short track ranks. Rowdy will run with the Pro All-Star Series at Oxford Plains Speedway on July 2nd and 3rd. That story is also on Short Track Scene.
And one more story over at Short Track Scene by Matt Weaver. After struggling early in 2024, Landon Huffman and Jimmy Mooring Racing have switched chassis brands. They're switching from R&S to PRWs. So Matt Weaver tells you all about it over at Short Track Scene. And then there's a few upcoming races coming up tomorrow night. Sal?
Yeah, actually, upcoming races Tuesday, tomorrow night, we got the dirt. We got the high limit racing at Riverside International Speedway at 7:15. You can watch that on Floor Racing. And you can also watch weekly racing from Millbridge Speedway at 6:15 p.m. on Dirt Vision. And then also you can watch weekly racing from Beaver Dam Raceway at 7:30, and that's also on Dirt Vision.
All right.
One more note was the Spears SRL Prolate Series ran this Saturday night over at Irwindale, and Cabe McClenney got his first ever win, and held off he held off Nash Youngren, who Nash had just got his first Prolate win at Irwindale a few weeks ago. Anyways, so Cabe, this is his first win in a Prolate model. He's been racing a lot. His family, wow. It's a small little family operated thing. And I talked to his dad today, and they're still in shock over the win. it's just, they still can't believe it. I mean, it's a little mom and pop team. They have no crew. Just the dad.
That's
two brothers that do all the work. Yes.
Congratulations to Caleb. That's fantastic. All right. We're going to move on now to the ARCA Menards Series race that was held at Talladega Super Speedway, the General Tire 200. Jake Finch won Saturday's General Tire 200, and it was his first career series victory, the 11th series start, and he became the 358th driver to earn at least one ARCA Menards Series win. So pretty cool to see Jake Finch in victory lane. I'm sure his dad, James Finch, was pretty happy about that.
Oh, yeah. He runs a lot of races and hardly gets a win. So, yeah, like Sharon said, congratulations on that. And then with that, then it says that Finch is the 20th ARCA Menards Series driver to earn his first series victory at Talladega Super Speedway, and the 18th consecutive different winner at Talladega dating all the way back to 2006.
Wow. Finch's win came more than 30 years after his father, James, won the Arca Menards Series race at Talladega as an owner, and that was with Jeff Purvis. He was driving, Jeff Purvis was driving that Phoenix Racing vehicle, and 15 years after his father won the NASCAR Cup Series race at Talladega with Brad Keselowski driving. Finch's winning crew chief on Saturday is Shannon Rush, who was also the crew chief on Keselowski's winning team going back to 2009. So a lot of you will remember James Finch and Phoenix Racing when they were part of the NASCAR Cup Series.
Oh, yes. And then from there, then you go to former NASCAR Cup Series champion Kurt Busch was at Victory Lane to offer congratulations. The fifth and final NASCAR Xfinity Series victory of Busch's career came while driving for James Finch's Phoenix Racing team at Daytona International Speedway in 2011. I think that was before, well, Kurt made a couple changes from there, but then ended up finishing his career, as everybody knows, with the 2311.
Yep. How cool is that?
Congratulations. Oh, yeah. And you still see Kurt at the track. He still goes to. Yep. Matter of fact, he attends all of the meetings and everything with 2311 still. So that's pretty awesome.
That is. Okay. Now, Finch became the first driver in the Arca Menards Series history at Talladega Super Speedway to lead every single lap. So hard to believe that nobody's ever done that before, but Jake Finch becomes the first driver in history to do it in the Arca Menards Series.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That is amazing. That is an amazing, especially at a super speedway.
It is.
Then the race was only slowed by the scheduled caution at the midway point. The nine laps under caution allowed the race to be run at an average speed of 158.626 miles per hour, the fifth fastest race, Arca Menards Series race at Talladega.
Wow. Well, hard to believe. Only one caution for a break at Talladega. Finch's Venturini Motorsports teammate, Chris Wright, was the driver finishing second, and that was a career best finish in the Arca Menards Series for Chris Wright. So congratulations to him as well.
And then, let me see, oh, here we are. Reigning Arca Menards Series champion Jesse Love was inducted into the Arca Wall of Champions inside the International Motorsports Hall of Fame on Friday afternoon. Love, who won the Arca Menards Series race at Talladega Super Speedway in 2023 while driving the same number 20 Toyota that Finch drove to victory in 2024, went on to earn his first career NASCAR Xfinity Series with win on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, that was pretty cool to see, and he certainly deserves to be on that Arca Wall of Champions. So pretty exciting day. So both Saturday Talladega winners, Jake Finch and Jesse Love, stayed the weekend in the same motorhome in the Talladega infield. So really cool to see that those friends both ended up in Victory Lane on Saturday.
Oh, yeah. That's true. And then Tanner Gray finished third for Joe Gibbs Racing, his best career Arca Menards Series finish.
And then the Daytona winner, Gus Dean, ran among the lead draft all afternoon. He ended up finishing fourth, giving Venturini Motorsports three of the top four finishers. It was his eighth top five finish in his last 11 series starts. So really good results for Gus Dean.
And then Christian Rose took the white flag in third position, but pulled out of the draft on the backstrips to try to make a move for the win. Unfortunately, no one won with him, and he dropped to fifth at the finish. All four of Rose's four career top five finishes have come in the last five ARCA Menards Series races, including two this year at Daytona, where he finished fourth.
Talladega. Okay, Sean Corr came in sixth place, followed by Amber Balkan, Andreas Perez, Frankie Munoz, and Tony Breidinger round out the top 10.
Christian Rose unofficially leads the ARCA Menards Series Championship standings by 1 point over Greg Van Alst, who finished 11th. Andreas Perez is unofficially third, just 3 points out of the lead, and Amber Balkan is just 6 points behind.
All right. The next race for the ARCA Menards Series is the General Tire 150 at Dover Motor Speedway on Friday, April the 26th. That race will be televised live on Fox Sports 1 at 5 p.m. Eastern and will be broadcast on select affiliates of the MRN Radio Network nationwide. That race will also have the ARCA Menards Series East drivers participating as well. It's one of those combination events where it's two series in one race. And they're all racing for points in those two different series. So really, really excited for the ARCA East as well as the ARCA Menards Series to be back on track next weekend.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be.
Do you want to cover the points? Do you want to cover the points for the ARCA Menards Series now?
Let me get there.
Well, they've got it. They don't have it updated yet, unfortunately.
Oh, they don't?
They said Christian Rose is at the top, followed by Greg Van Alst and Andreas Perez. I'm not sure if the rest of this is quite right or not.
It says that it's all unofficial.
Okay.
So that's probably why they haven't updated it.
Okay, so we'll have to wait until they update it more. But we'll go ahead and move on to the ARCA West Series. Yeah, they raced out at Kevin Harvick's Kern Raceway. You were there, right, Sal?
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. They were racing the MMI Oil Workers 150 presented by the West Coast Stock Car Motorsports Hall of Fame. And Cole Raz raced side-by-side with Trevor Huddleston for the final 10 laps, nosing Huddleston out at the checkered flag to win the race at the famed Kevin Harvick's Kern Raceway by 0.058 seconds. It was Raz's first ARCA Menards Series West victory and his fourth career start. That had to be pretty exciting. I remember when his brother was racing in the series, and now we have Cole Raz to watch.
Oh, yeah. He talked a little bit about he's talking about Jerry Pitts, you know, and how long it's been, you know, since they've had their last win. So, Grayson's last win, well, his first win was in 2015.
Wow, that's hard to believe.
Yeah, it was in 2015. So that tells you how long ago. That tells you how long ago the in between.
Yep.
So then Raz became the 209th different driver to win at least one ARCA Menards Series West victory. He joins his brother Grayson Raz as a West winner. Grayson was 177th different winner with his victory at All-American Speedway in 2017. Grayson served as Cole's race winning spotter on Saturday night.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, as we mentioned earlier, Trevor Huddleston finished second in his 25th career top five finish. And I was reading earlier, too, that the Huddlestons are now leasing Kevin Harvick's Kern Raceway. So that's pretty cool that he did so well in their first race there as reigning leasers.
Yeah. And then from there they go to Tyler Reif, started from the General Tire Pole, his first of the season and third career pole award. He finished third after leading 104 of the race's first 150 laps. It's his fourth top five finish in his last seven series starts.
Wow. Reigning series champion Sean Hingorani was a last-minute substitute for Joe Farre, whose company Sigma Engineering Services is assisting with the salvage operation of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. Hingorani, who won this race last year, drove to a fourth-place finish. He assumed the lead in the Arca Menards Series West Championship standings by 2 points over Tyler Reif. So that's going to be a tight battle there.
Yeah. Actually, Sean started with Shiga Hattori Racing, and then something came up. So Hingorani went, and they want to put this car together on Wednesday for Sean because, you know, since Joe was, you know, out of state.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, yeah, they put the car together last minute for him. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's, they're not sure if he's going to finish out the season in that or not, but he won't be back with the Tory Racing.
Wow.
To finish out the season.
Well, I hope he is able to finish out the season.
Yeah. And then from there, then we go to, let me see what we're doing here.
Nick Giovinetti's.
Oh yeah, Nick Giovinetti finished fifth, his second career series top five finish, and first since he finished fourth at All American Speedway in October 2018, 19 starts ago. Yeah, he's with the new team with Jans Tone. So he's got a whole new look on life.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Team, so. Yeah. Actually, I'm doing
yeah,
the pole.
Yeah, we'll have him come back again sometime.
Yeah, I've been talking to him. I'm a photographer this season, so it won't be hard to get him back
cool.
to. Yeah, it won't be hard
to catch
up
with him.
Yeah,
that's good news. PJ Pedroncelli finished eighth in his first series start since he finished 16th at All American Speedway back in October of 22. And I remember Mason Mitchell, Sal?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good to see him back on track, too.
I talked to him.
Cool.
I talked to him for a little bit, and he goes, man, I go, you probably don't remember me. I go, we had you on our radio show. He goes, 2005, probably, what, nine years ago?
Yeah.
I go, somewhere around there. Yeah, somewhere around there. So, anyways,
yeah,
Mason Mitchell, 2000.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I met his mom out at Iowa Speedway a few years ago, too.
Okay. And then from there, then we go to Mason Mitchell, 2014 Arca Menards Series champion, made his return to the Arca platform and its first West start, but was sidelined early with overheating problems. He was credited with 18th position after completing 58 laps. He's doing a lot of dirt racing back east, so that's why he's not.
Oh, cool.
He's not sure how many more, if he's going to do any more Arca Menards Series race lessons, because like I said, when I asked him, he was going to go to like Sonoma or, you know, a couple other tracks, and he goes, my dirt program is taking over.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope he does, and even though it was 58 laps, I think it was good to see him making that effort back in the Arca Menards Series. I'd love to see him do more, but I understand he's got to make that decision based on the information that he has.
Yeah.
Now, John Borneman III and Takuma Koga came together on the second lap doing damage to both of their cars. Borneman recovered to finish 11th, but Koga soldiered on to a 15th place finish. So not the easiest of days for both of those drivers.
No, it wasn't. And yeah, it was, you know, it kind of wasn't really something you really wanted to see. Anyways, and then Jack Wood, who came back to the Arkham Menards series after being with the trucks for the last couple of seasons, ran among the top five most of the night, but fell off the pace with a flat tire with a handful of laps remaining, relegating him to 12th at the finish. And actually, Jack's running the number 16 car for Bill McAnally Racing.
Oh, very nice. All right, the next race for the Arkham Menards Series West is the Portland 112. That will be held on Friday, May the 31st, and the race will be available via live streaming on Flow Racing. So really good races in both of those series, and it was really good to see the Arkham Menards Series back on track with both of those races on Saturday. Now, the truck series is off for a couple of weeks. They are not racing again this weekend, but their next race will actually be the Heart of America 200 at Kansas Speedway on Saturday, May the 4th, starting at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Expect the green flag sometime around 8:13 p.m. Eastern. Everything will be televised on Fox Sports 1, as well as MRN and Sirius XM NASCAR Radio. They'll have practice and qualifying on Saturday, earlier in the day, May 4th, starting at 12:05 p.m. Eastern Time. So, again, they won't be on track this weekend at Dover. It'll just be the Cup Series and the Xfinity Series, but we will see the Truck Series back at Kansas. So what are your thoughts about both of the Arkham Menards Series races, Sal?
Yeah, I didn't see the Arkham Menards race. I didn't see the one that Jake won, but I like I How said, about- I wasn't at Kern.
Oh, you were not at Kern? I thought you were going to be.
No, I wasn't Kern. I wasn't Kern, but it's kind of hard to really watch a race while you're
taking photos.
Yeah, while you're taking photos, I try to watch as much as I can.
Okay, I guess it was a pretty heavy battle between Cole Raz and Trevor Huddleston. I guess Trevor wasn't happy, but he said that when he saw how happy the fans were with the thrilling finish, if they were happy, then he was going to be okay with it.
Yeah, it was the main thing. It was good to see that 22 cars. I think it was 22 cars they had that started the race because they had 21 of them. Cody Kimmelly came on Saturday because Friday night he couldn't practice because he was he plays baseball. So I mean, it was really good to see, to see a big field because we haven't the car counts maybe have been horrible, to say the least. You know,
well,
I mean, last year we received 10 and 12 cars. Yeah, we received 10 and 12 cars, 13 cars. You know, for them to get 21, 22 cars at especially Kern, you know, because they, you know, Phoenix and Sonoma, they always get big car counts.
Right. Well, that's good news. I'm glad to hear it. Sal, we're going to go ahead and move over to the Xfinity Series race. That was at Talladega on Saturday. Saturday was just loaded with races. But anyway, this one was exciting as well, especially for Jesse Love, who stretched his fuel mileage to win his first Xfinity Series race at Talladega. It was a typically wild double overtime finish for the AgPro 300 at Talladega. He crossed the finish line by a slight 0.141 seconds ahead of Riley Herbst. Now, getting redemption from earlier this season at Atlanta, Jesse Love, who drives the number two for RCR Racing, stretched his fuel tank to win the race at Talladega. Again, his first career start, or his first career win in nine starts. Riley Herbst made a very spirited rally in overtime to finish runner-up. That's his best finish this season. Anthony Alfredo led the charge for the underfunded teams, which also saw the number 42 of Leland Honeyman and Brennan Poole crack the top five. Sheldon Creed, Cesar Baccarella, Matt Benedetto, Jeb Burton, and Cole Custer rounded out the top 10. Now, RCR swept all three stages. Love earned his series-high four-stage victory in the opening stage, and Austin Hill, who led a race-high 41 laps, won the second stage. There were 34 lead changes among 16 drivers and 6 cautions for 28 yellow flag laps. The average speed of the race was 131.323 miles per hour. The highest finishing... The highest rookie was Jesse Love in first place. What are your thoughts about our top 10 finishers here, Sal?
Yeah, it was a good race. I mean, congrats, Jesse Love on that win. I think if they had gone maybe a lap or maybe another lap, I think Riley would have gotten. I think Riley and his little bit more experience, I think he would have won around Jesse. He was catching. He was right there, and I think Riley just needed one more lap to get him. But man, it was just that last caution. All the wrecking that went on. Of course the TV went nuts. Oh yeah, look at Haley Deegan. She's going to be the first woman driver since.
Then she got caught up in that wreck.
Yeah. Danica Patrick, she got pushed back on the last restart. She was sitting third or fourth on the restart. And, she's going to be, the next, she's going to break Danica's record, having the highest finish, on a super speedway. And then next thing you know, when the race went green, nobody got behind her, nobody helped her, and she fell fell right to the back, finished 12th. But I thought at the end, Riley had the Carter, to do it. I mean, Jesse Love, he had a couple good blocks on Honeyman, to keep the lead. Because it was that last caution that took Brandon Jones out of the race, congratulations. Oh, and also took out, you feel bad because he does good at every track, and then they talk about the super speedway, and it just seems
Poor drivers taken out.
Yeah, and Austin Hill is one of them.
Yep, quite a few. In fact, just about everybody, there were quite a few still running, at least 27 cars running at the end of the race, some a lap or more down. There were 21 drivers that finished all 124 laps. Justin Allgaier was not one of them. He was out on lap 24 because of an accident. Jeffrey Earnhardt had engine problems that took him out on lap 46. Then there was that accident we were just talking about, four drivers taken out, including Brandon Jones, Ryan Truex, Jeremy Clements, and Sam Mayer. all out on lap 65. On lap 111, two other drivers had an accident, taking them out of the race. Patrick Emmerling and Jordan Anderson were out on 111. On lap 113, Parker Retzlaff actually had an ignition problem that took him out of the race. A lot of people thought Parker Kligerman would be there at the end, but he had an accident that took him out on lap 117. And on lap 120, Kyle Weatherman was out of the race due to the damaged vehicle policy. So, again, it was an exciting race. I was happy for Jesse Love. He took the Arca Menards Series by storm, and I kind of thought he might do the same in the Xfinity Series. I thought it would take him until at least halfway through the season, but we're at Talladega in April, and he's already got his first win, so that's pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah, it is. He was real excited for the win, you know what, and, I mean, he earned it, he deserved it, you know, and it was great to see him, you know, get that win, and, you know, finally get the, you know, especially this early in the season, you know, I'm sure we're going to see, you know, maybe possibly one or two more wins out of him.
Yeah, I've got that feeling too, Sal. I think we're going to see more wins from Jesse Love. Do you want to go ahead and cover the points report?
Yeah, the points we have, Chandler Smith still leading the points. Cole Custer sitting in second. Austin Hill in third. And Jesse Love, who now has a win. He's at fourth. He's locked into the chase. So and then fifth, we have Justin Allgaier and Riley Herbst right off the top six. And then from there, then we go down to A.J. Allmendinger. Sammy Smith, Parker Kligerman, Sheldon Creed, Ryan C., and that's the Alfredo round up the top 12, but then we still have Sam Mary who has that win. So he'll take the spot away from Anthony Alfredo.
Right. The person who two people have the most playoff points, 10 or more, Austin Hill in third place has 12 with his two race wins and two stage wins. Chandler Smith edges him out, though, at 13 playoff points. He's got the two wins, but he's got three stage wins that give him that extra point. So pretty amazing. I think we're going to have a big three this year. What do you think, Sal?
Yeah, could be. I mean, it's gonna be exciting to see how the season ends up, you know, and plus, you know, you got that rookie in there, Jesse Love, you know, who's really racing like a veteran in the series.
Yeah. All right, Ryan Sieg won the Talladega Dash for Cash. So I do have some audio here from him, Sal, and we can take about 5 minutes to hear what he had to say, and then we'll move on to the Cup Series review, okay?
Okay.
All right, we're going to go ahead and roll into our post-race press conference. We've now been joined by today's Dash for Cash winner, Ryan C., who won the $100,000 bonus. Congratulations on that win with the bonus, Ryan. Just talk to us a little bit about your race and then just what that, you know, bonus money means for your team.
It means it's huge for our small team. And sponsorship's hard to come by, and this just makes everything that much easier. So hopefully I get some of it. It was a rough one. I thought I threw it away myself, and we were lucky enough to get the caution at the end and come back and beat the 16. So it all worked out, and pretty extraordinary for our small team.
All right, we'll go ahead and take questions. We'll start in the back with Justin.
Justin Schuler kicking the tires. Does this kind of make up for last weekend, I guess?
I mean, it makes it better, you know what I mean? But still, I wanted to win last week, and that was tough to come out of that one and not win and be so close. But the photo finish, and it was great for SIAPS and Ford, and we have more coming up. So we're in the DasherCast again, going to Dover. So I think that's more of hopefully we repeat of Texas, just on the other end, and then we have Charlotte coming up. So a couple tracks that are pretty exciting for us. We just got to put in the hard work, and we'll be able to achieve.
And then for like a small team like yours, family-owned team, working with the 38 as kind of like an affiliate, I guess, of some sorts, what does this bonus mean for the team and the organization as a whole? How much further can you guys progress with that kind of a win like this?
For a race win or the 100,000? Oh, okay. Yeah, no, across the board, it just makes everything easier. You know what I mean? We have – that goes into the payroll, and we're still trying to get more employees as we go through the year. So we're a little short staff, so this will help out, pay the – you know what I mean? The payroll and everything else that goes along with this – you know what I mean? The sport that we're in and everything that we were able to do.
All right. Any additional questions? Okay, we'll go up to John Newby up front. Up here up front.
BNBC Sports. So, Kirsten, can you just give me some more insight into, you know, like how much effort goes into helping your team contend with, you know, a lot of these, like, juggernauts? Because, like you said, you're short-staffed, and I know it's not cheap, long hours. Can you just give some more insight into that?
Yeah, we, you know what I mean, we probably only have, like, 14 employees total between four cars, so that's Kyle and I included in those people. So, you know what I mean, I guess you could count us for, you know what I mean, two more, but still, you know what I mean, it's tough. So, you know what I mean, it's pretty amazing. We are across the board running good with all of our cars, and last week we had three of them in the top 20, and they were all pretty good today. You know what I mean, it's just some of them are, you know what I mean, Kyle's just experienced. Eventually, he ended up pretty good. So it's a lot of long hours, and like I said, the money helps out for sure, make everything easier. Because like this is an expensive sport, so this is a step in the right direction. We just got to do it again next week.
All right. Any final questions for Ryan? All right, Ryan. Congratulations again on that bonus, and hopefully you guys enjoy that this week.
Yes, thank you.
All right. He brings up how difficult it is as a small team to compete against the bigger name teams. Pretty exciting. And I just want to mention that he was able to win that $100,000 bonus. Next week at Dover, he's going to be competing against Jesse Love, Briley Herbst, and Anthony Alfredo, another small team. So pretty exciting for those guys to get another chance at that $100,000 bonus. Are you still with me, Sal?
Yeah.
Sal? Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Sharon. I had to put on mute for a minute. My boss was texting me some work stuff for tomorrow.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was just saying it's really cool to see Ryan Sieg win that $100,000 as a small team. That really does make a huge difference. And then he'll get a chance to compete again next week at Dover along with Jesse Love, Riley Herbst, and Anthony Alfredo, another small team.
You know, and I think the only one that was left was Allmendinger, but he was just so far back.
Yeah.
You know, there was no way he was going to, you know, Ryan Sieg just needed to stay clean, to pick up that bonus money.
Exactly. And I know that wasn't the greatest of races for those guys, but they were the best of the Xfinity Series regulars. So that's pretty cool. All right, we're going to go ahead and move on to the NASCAR Cup Series. And what's really cool is Michael Jordan was there when Tyler Reddick took the checkered flag in a wild Talladega finish. He prevailed in a typically frantic Talladega Super Speedway one run to the checkered flag. It was a race in which he narrowly avoided a multi-car crash in the closing 400 yards, coming from third place out of the fourth turn to earn the win by a slight 0.028 seconds when race leader Michael McDowell crashed trying to block competitors approaching the finish line. McDowell's move slowed the bottom line, then that allowed Reddick to take the high lane and motor right on to his first victory of the season and the sixth of his career. Again, it was the first of the year, the first at Talladega, and his sixth of his career. Brad Keselowski came home with another second-place finish, followed by Noah Gregson, Ricky Stenhouse Jr., Alex Bowman, Anthony Alfredo, still up in the top there, William Byron, Todd Gilliland, Daniel Hemric, and Harrison Burton, rounding out the top 10. Michael McDowell was the pole winner and was leading when they came off of turn four on the last lap. Brad Keselowski moved down the track to try to make a... Sal, I don't know what you're doing, but it's making a loud noise there.
There's a truck that just went scraping by outside. I have my doors open.
Oh, okay. Anyway, Brad Keselowski moved down the track trying to make a move for the lead when McDowell moved down to block him and got hooked. He then spun out, collecting all the other cars. Reddick, who was leading at the white flag, had led for five previous laps, and then he went on, took the lead, and won. Stage one was won by the number two of Austin Cindric. Stage two was won by the number 22 of Joey Logano. There were 72 lead changes among 23 drivers and four cautions for 21 yellow flag laps. The average speed of the race was 155.977 miles per hour. That's a lot of lead changes and a lot of cautions there, only four cautions over 21 laps. But what are your thoughts about those top 10 finishers and another second-place finish for Brad Keselowski?
That was a lot of carnage, I mean, when you think about it. You know, Brad is, I pull for Brad every week. He's got to be still my favorite driver. And I hope he can get a win this year before the season's over. I mean, he puts a lot of time into his program. You know, I know a lot of people don't like him for whatever reason. But, to take on the role that he took on with Jack Roush, you know, to help him develop, you know, work on the Fords, you know, and get them, you know, back to racing, you know, to a competitive state again, you know, took a lot for him.
It did, and I like you. I like Brad Keselowski, and I've been rooting for him, too.
You know, it's just too bad that McDowell made the moves that he made, you know, and caused the carnage that he caused. But I guess they say once, you know, one too many, and, you know, and it's, I guess it's kind of like when you have a drink. You know, they say one too many, you're going to crash. I guess he found out the same thing, one too many, and he started the big one.
Yeah, he ended up in 31st place.
Yeah, he was destined for a good finish. That's a sad thing.
Yeah,
he was destined for a good finish. But, you know, you look up and down the up and down the results, you know, you look at some of the names, you know, it's just their names, with the exception of like William Byron, Alex Bowman, but I mean, they're the top 10 are just names you're not used to seeing, you know.
Right.
Alfredo was
the highest finishing rookie.
Yeah. And, you know, then, you know, Todd Gilliland, congratulations on him on an eighth place finish, you know, Daniel Hamilton, ninth. You know, Harrison Burton, you know, picking up the 10th. But Tyler Reddick, you know, to get that win, you know, that was huge, you know, for 2311 Racing. But Tyler is that kind of a driver, you know, that he can, you know, I don't know. He's doing great things with that team. I think that if Tyler was to get on, I mean, I don't even know which we're a powerhouse team. There's no room for him. But I really think he could do a lot. He could do a lot better on a you know, on a better team.
Yeah, well, we'll wait and see what happens there. I will say, you know, Toyota and Chevy have been the only manufacturers to win this year. I don't think a Ford has won yet this season, but they are knocking on the door. There were at least four Fords in the top 10 at Talladega, and I know that's not necessarily a good judge of it, but Brad Keselowski's been second 2 weeks in a row at two different types of tracks. So he is doing exactly what Jack Roush wanted him to do over at RFK Racing, and that is to make those teams more competitive. So we'll see how that plays out for the rest of the year. There were, let's see,
you know,
running. Go ahead.
Well, you know, that's going to be interesting next year when Stuart Haas, you know, changes manufacturers.
Oh, yeah. Well, we don't know that for sure, but there's rumors that it could happen.
Oh, I mean, you know, it's, I don't know how you say it, it's kind of, it's almost kind of, you know, inevitable that it's going to happen.
Yeah, I know. But we got to make sure we state that it is a rumor at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's been no official announcement.
Yeah, I was watching the wreck
okay.
over again, and McDowell just should have held his line.
Yeah, it would have. You never know what would have happened otherwise. There were 33 cars running at the end of this race, some multiple laps down, but quite a few of those cars, 30 of those cars finished all 188 laps, which was pretty good. Christopher Bell was out on lap 132 because of an accident. Denny Hamlin also had an accident, along with Eric Jones and Bubba Wallace. They were all out on lap 154. I heard that Eric Jones had to go to the hospital after that wreck for the hard hit that he took. Justin Haley and John Hunter Nemechek both out. Or they finished the race, but they were four laps down. Also, B.J. McLeod finished the race, but he was at least a lap down. And Michael McDowell, again, ended up spinning out, and instead of winning the race, he ended up in 31st place. I can't blame him for trying to block and kind of hold his position, but at the same time, it's so tricky to do at a track like Talladega. Those guys are going so fast. And just the slightest little bit of air movement can change the whole dynamic.
You know, it's true, you know, and everybody wants to win.
Yep, everybody wants to win.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and cover the points, Sal.
Okay, the points are, let me see where they're right here. Nobody wants to know about the other points. The points are Kyle Larson still leading the points. Martin Truex Jr. sitting in second. Chase Elliott in third with one win. William Byron in fourth with three wins. Tyler Reddick in fifth with one win. Denny Hamlin in sixth with two wins. Ryan Blaney, seventh, and Ty Gibbs is an eighth. And then from there, then we go down to Ross Chastain in ninth. Alex Bowman in 10th. Bubba Wallace in 11th. And Chase Briscoe, 12th. Christopher Bell, 13th. Brad Keselowski, 14th. Joey Logano, 15th. And Chris Buescher rounds out the top 15. But then you got Daniel Suarez. It's right there.
He's got one win, too, so he's going to displace Buescher.
Yeah.
Yeah, Daniel Suarez Buescher in that 16th spot because he has the win. So, yeah, there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 drivers with victories, 2 drivers with multiple victories being William Byron and Denny Hamlin. So it's always the second, you know, when we get down to 10 races before the playoffs is when it gets really exciting to see just how many drivers are going to make it into the playoffs on wins alone and how many are going to be in on points.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's, you know, and it's even hard to even call anything, you know, even at the halfway break, you know, because
mm-hmm.
a lot can happen, you know.
Yep. Yep, that is so true. So are you going to be at a racetrack this weekend, Sal?
No, I think we're off this weekend.
Okay.
I need to check my schedule. I've been trying to deal with my regular job, but I'm pretty sure that we are off this weekend.
Okay. I'm really envious that you were able to go to Kevin Harvick's Kern Raceway this weekend. I bet that was pretty exciting and a lot of fun for you.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's I'll tell you the truth. It's the same as the old Kern. You know, there's
yeah.
really nothing different about it. You know, it's just, you know, Kevin and Tim own it now. You know, but we still haven't seen Kevin at the track. You know, the week that he was supposed to be the Grand Marshal was the week we got the rain out. You know, so we still haven't seen him at the track. So it's
hopefully it'll happen sometime this year.
Oh yeah, it definitely will because once Fox, you know, once they switch, you know,
NBC.
He does a race. I'm sure they're going to change all the color commentators, so they'll have more time to come out and, you know, and it's the track and, you know, stuff like that. So, and who knows, we might
yep.
even get Keelan, you know, he might even read Keelan's legend. I'm sure he will, you know, and race it over here. He might not. He might just figure, you know, it's my track. You know what? You know, maybe it's not a good idea, you know, for my son to race on my track. There's always that are like that. And then there's some that will, you know, because they always think that they're going to get preferential treatment.
Well, I'm glad you were able to be there. I hope you had a good time. And Sal, we'll be back again next Monday night for our review of Dover.
Yes, we will. So we'll talk to everybody next week. Everybody have a good weekend. Stay safe. And we'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Thanks, Sal. Take care.
Okay. 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 Come on.
Bye-bye. All right, 9:30 p.m. Eastern time. That means it's time for us to start our NASCAR Hot Topic Sound Off. One of our participants is here, and that's Jay Huseman. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Sharon, it's great to be here on a Monday night, especially after a great weekend of racing.
Yes, indeed. I believe Andy is also going to be joining us. So we'll look forward to bringing him into the queue as soon as he becomes available. And we've got a few hot topics here to discuss. And there's Andy now. We'll bring him into the queue and welcome him to the show. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, good evening, Sharon. How are you tonight?
Doing very well, thank you. And looking forward to our hot topic sound-off discussion. Jay, why don't you go ahead and get us started with the first hot topic?
Well, I think we got to back up as far as Friday then, as far as Kyle Larson being not allowed to qualify, had took a penalty, one-lap penalty to start the race, and we'll see if there's any more forthcoming. This is one of those of whether or not the at-track penalty was considered enough.
Okay. Now, just to clarify, I think it had something to do with the roof rails, that penalty that he got at Talladega. I just want to make sure. The car chief was ejected.
Yes.
They did the pass-through penalty at the race. And they did say here that no additional penalties assessed by NASCAR. It was unapproved adjustments to the roof rails of the number five car that caused that car chief to be ejected from the race and the pass-through penalty. So, Andy, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, obviously, you know, an infraction occurred here with the five car. You know, it's been well documented on this show and, of course, from NASCAR the past few seasons that rules are the rules. You're not allowed to make changes to certain things. In this case, it was the roof rails and whatever took place obviously wasn't to the liking of NASCAR per the rules. And, you know, they had to serve the penalty that fit the crime, I guess, you know. And so it is good that they took care of the penalty at the track. And it looks like there'll be nothing further to come from this, which is a good thing. But, yeah, obviously crew members ejected. They couldn't qualify and then had to make a pass-through penalty. I'm not even sure where Larson finished, but I think they were able to claw their way out of the deficit by the end of the race. But, yeah, just obviously, you know, you can't manipulate really anything with this next-gen car. And, you know, they got caught doing it, and they had to pay the price for it. So, I think NASCAR has been pretty clear about that over the past couple, three seasons, and certainly they enforced that rule once again.
Yeah, a couple of things here. I guess it was something that they did as they were pushing the car to inspection. They made a modification to the roof rails. NASCAR caught it and assessed the penalty. Larson actually finished in 21st place at that race. One thing that I thought was good is that they assessed their penalties right away. I don't think that there's going to be any additional penalties assessed based on what's written at J-Ski's anyway. But I like that they assessed it right away. They took care of it. The penalty was assessed and served, and now we can kind of move on. I'd like to see more of that type of thing versus us having to wait. I know there's situations where that cannot be avoided, and so there are still going to be penalties where we have to wait and find out what the verdict is after NASCAR reviews. But in this case, they could assess it right away, and I think that was a good thing. Not that we like to see penalties. We don't like necessarily to see penalties happen. But the fact that they took care of it right away, I think, is a definite positive. Jay, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think to me the key factor is it wasn't a part they had on there and tried to bring through tech. As you said, it was the crew as they were pushing the car from the tech line onto the starting grid. And obviously there was no direct footage or whatever of it, but NASCAR Fox tried to do a replay of it and explain how it happened during their pre-race. As they were pushing it, they appeared to push on the roof rail and bend it, shape it, whatever, we saw this back when we'd see crewmen, jackmen, tire changers hip checking the side of the car to bend the fenders. So I do think that the at track penalty there is the best call. Like I said, it wasn't something that was, and truthfully, without seeing the team having done it, the question becomes, did they really intend to, or did somebody just have their hand in the wrong spot pushing the car? And I understand they still got to penalize because, as Larry McReynolds says, you can't judge intent. But whether or not it was even really intentional or if it just happened to be that he was pushing and his hand slid up the car and hit the rail, we don't know that for a fact. That it happened, you know, one way or another, and NASCAR penalized because of it. My issue is more of, depending on the track, what the effect of the penalty is. If you look at a track like Martinsville, if you have to do a pass-through penalty, you're going to lose two laps. At Talladega, he eventually lost the lap, but was the first car in a position to go a lap down. Versus if they do the pass-through penalty versus hold them on pit road for a lap and make sure they're one lap down completely, because it varies from track to track. To make it up at Martinsville would be a lot tougher because, like I said, you're probably going to go two laps down with a pass-through penalty. And at Talladega, he barely went one lap down and was able to right away get the free pass.
Okay. Andy, any additional thoughts on your part?
Yeah, nothing to really add to this, I don't think. You know, just a matter of they got caught doing something they shouldn't and served a penalty for it. But I think that it really just reiterates the fact that you can't really mess with anything on this car. And if you get caught doing so, you'll have to pay the price for it. So I think that the penalty fit the crime, and I think NASCAR did what was correct in this case. And hopefully, you know, these teams continue to realize they can't make changes to this car, or they'll have to serve a penalty for it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they did catch it, though, because you said it was after the inspection, Jay, and their way to the pit road. You know, and you brought up a good point, too, about even if it was accidental, it still happens, so the penalty still has to be assessed. But chances are it probably wasn't accidental. And to Andy's point, yeah, if you do get caught committing the crime, you got to pay the piper, if you will. And that's exactly what happened. So there's not a whole lot to add here for me either. So what are your final thoughts, Jay, as we close this one out and move on to the next?
Well, it's ironic that this is to the point we're at, and let's go with the assumption it was intentional. Even when they walk the cars out to pit road and are sitting there during pre-race, there is, I believe, at least one inspector assigned to every car to keep an eye on it for reasons like this. And that's one of the things of how close the competition is and how subtle these things are being done. Think back to with the tape on, was it Chase Elliott's, I believe, which was also a Hendrick Motorsports car, coincidentally, that, again, it was just that little tug on tape, you know, that they thought wasn't going to get caught or spotted or whatever. So they're trying these things of real discreetly. Obviously, they're doing it post-tech or post-race because just that little bit of an advantage is what they're looking for. So that tells you how tough the competition is.
Yeah, that's so true. Andy, what do you think our next hot topic should be?
Well, Kyle Busch was quoted after this race as saying that he hates the current next-gen car.
Okay. Jay?
Well, reading into this one, it kind of caught me off guard. I thought maybe it was just a bad day. You know, he wasn't happy with where he finished. I know we always hear a lot about the it's tough to pass. In this case, it also went into with this car, and it's not one of the areas we've really talked a whole lot about, but the fuel mileage on it is different. And that's become prevalent when it comes to the, I guess now we're calling them drafting tracks of Talladega, Daytona, and Atlanta. when it comes to that, the pace slows down in order to save fuel. And he expressed the frustration with that, that you can't go out there and race full throttle because then you're going to be at a disadvantage. And we saw that coming into play in some race strategy with the Toyotas versus the other manufacturers. So it's an interesting thing, and it's maybe something NASCAR needs to look at as far as, I know it was a little bit smaller fuel tank. I think it went down to from 22 to 18 gallons, if I'm not mistaken. But I very well could be on that because I don't know that for a fact. But the fuel mileage issue with it, whatever the size of the tank, the car the way it is, apparently does a lot different as far as fuel mileage. And that was part of his frustration. I think some of it is right now, I know Jimmy Johnson talked about it, of how to drive this car is different when you talk about driving it off the right front versus the right rear. And he talked about having to change and adapt to that. And we knew that when it came out that some of these drivers, the veteran drivers, were going to possibly struggle with that more than the younger drivers who didn't know any better, had no other habits. I wouldn't say bad habits, but different habits, because a driver like Kyle Busch is wanting to drive things the way he's always has or is used to, and this was a change, and is struggling with that change on how to adapt to this car, I think is part of it. But he brings up a good point with the fuel mileage issue. I know that gets talked about, like I said, a lot during these draftings races.
Okay. Kyle Busch, he hates to lose, let's face it. He does not like to lose, and when he loses or gets caught up in a wreck like is likely to happen at a track like Talladega, he's going to be not happy about it. And I do think that sometimes drivers express their frustration at the end of the race when somebody's got a mic in their face, and it comes off harsher, really, really harsh. Now, Kyle Busch also has made it clear that he's not happy with the less practice. And I'm not sure. I don't think they had a practice this week. I think that they went right into qualifying without a practice. And we know that he's been outspoken about that as well, that when they don't get a chance to practice, it hurts his team as far as getting the car set up correctly. But Talladega is also one of those tracks where you can get caught up in a big mess, not of your own doing, and it can end your day. And that's got to be super frustrating as well. So the fuel saving, it's one of those things. NASCAR is taking a lot of heat for this car, the next-gen car. And I know that they're looking into it and trying to do everything they can. But I do think that sometimes we expect every race to be the best race ever, and it's not always going to be that way. To me, the fuel saving and strategy that can take place on the track is sometimes exciting. Sometimes it's not. I kind of get into it a little bit, but I don't know. I do know that NASCAR is looking at these things. They do listen to the drivers when they speak up. Kyle Busch has made no qualms about making his feelings known. But I do know that he gets especially frustrated when he cannot finish a race and have a good finish. So I think that's got to be taken into consideration when he's making some of these comments as well. But I know that the frustration is real for a lot of these drivers. Andy, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is frustration, certainly, in light of being caught up in that last lap wreck. And he's got a good point. It's like if you just ride where you're running, you know, you're not going to make any forward progress. And if you try to win, it seems like, you know, everyone gets caught up in a wreck. So it's interesting to see the evolution of super speedway racing. It seems like it's always changing, sometimes mm-hmm. for the better, sometimes for the worse. And it's interesting that the teams have really employed the fuel strategy game, which, you know, I didn't see it as a bad thing. I think I've said it before on the show that, you know, fuel strategy and fuel saving is still trying to win the race. So I still view it as, you know, you're still putting forth the effort to try to win or to try to better yourself for the end of the race. So I don't necessarily hate it, but in this case, you know, riding around 50 to 60% throttle or whatever it is like that, you know, isn't, I mean, to me, that's kind of just riding around. And you, it's almost like, to sum up this race, they rode around all day saving fuel and then went all for broke at the end, and then they piled the field up coming to the checkered flag, which I suppose is every super speedway race for the last 20-something years. But, you know, I don't know. I kind of have mixed feelings on it. I can understand the strategy side of it, and I don't necessarily hate that, but at the same time, like, I get Kyle's frustration of, you know, if you just ride, you know, saving fuel, or you just ride where you're at, you're going to finish mediocre. But if you try to actually win, then you'll wreck and finish even worse. So in other words, he's basically saying no matter what you do, the outcome could be bad. Now, of course, that's not the case for everybody. Somebody has to win, in this case, Tyler Reddick. But I don't know. I got to be honest. I hope that they can find a solution to prevent these guys from riding around partial throttle for a whole fuel run. I don't know if that means cutting the fuel cell size. I think one of you said that they've already cut it down to 18 gallons, you know, but it's like you could cut it down to 5 gallons and they would still find a way to stretch the fuel an extra lap or two. So I honestly don't have a good solution. I don't know what that is, but, you know, hopefully we can fix this to where they're out there racing hard, lap after lap, chair. And I know you've said it to where that's what you want to see is hard racing for the whole race. I agree with that. That's what I'd like to see. That's what I'd like to see too at some point. So I don't know. It's just, it's like no matter what you do, teams always find ways to try to stretch things a bit. So we'll see what happens. But certainly as far as Kyle's concerned, I completely get where he's coming from.
Yeah, I think that's true. Jay, what's your follow-up?
Yeah, I'm with Andy. I see both sides of it. When you talk about a strategy, that's normally if it's one or two teams. This is the entire pack as a whole. And we saw Toyota actually try and change that by coming in together when they came back out. I really wish that had been able to play out. The six Toyotas pitted as a group, could come back out and run full throttle as the other competitors were going to have to then pick up the pace and stay in front of them or possibly let them catch them, and it'd be a mixed bag. Unfortunately, we didn't get to see that play out, and just like any strategy, there's a good side to it, a bad side. It seemed like a good plan, and it was interesting to wait and see how it was going to play out, but as we've talked about this before with teammates or manufacturer partners or whatever, you put them all together, if something happens, you wipe them all out, which is what we saw with Toyota's. Three of them, fortunately, were able to recover, get through it, but you wiped out half of your group just by one little bobble, and we know how that can happen at these drafting speedways. So, you know, that's the downside of it. When Ford started doing it, especially Stuart Haas Racing, it seemed to be the thing to do, and that's what Toyota was going with, but you run that risk of, if the one in front of you wipes out, you're taking out your entire team or manufacturer. So no matter what, as Andy said, no matter what rule they put in play, these teams are smart enough and you give them enough time, they're going to figure it out and find a workaround or a strategy to combat that. As a whole, when you watch it, if we didn't have the technology that we have today to see that they're running 60% throttle or whatever and saving the fuel, you wouldn't know it. I mean, you're not going to look out at the track. If you're at the track, no scanner, nothing, you're not going to look out at the racing on the track and go, hey, they're holding back a certain percentage and doing this. So from that aspect, I don't know that it affects the enjoyment of the race as far as that. It's just a matter that we have that information and know that's what they're doing, then we see it as not as entertaining or whatever. I go back to, you know, when they did different things to bring the car speed down, you really on the track watching notice a difference between, 190 miles an hour versus 200 miles an hour? Probably not. If you are an extreme car person, you may be able to tell by hearing the engine or whatever that they're down on horsepower. But honestly, I don't think you're going to see that big a difference between that 10 miles per hour. But because they know the information, they apply it to what they're seeing in actuality, if that all makes sense.
Yeah, I hear you, and I don't like it when they're not really racing for most of the race, but I understand it when it comes to I kind of understand it when it comes to super speedway racing. Super speedway racing is not my favorite kind of racing. I will say that. I liked it when they had the tandem races. I thought that was a lot of fun to watch. I think the teams were engaged and working together and communicating with one another. But the same thing can happen with the tandem racing, too, that you were talking about. And that was that, you know, one little slip-up can take out both teams. And then, you know, you end up not finishing the race. So I don't know what the answer is for super speedway racing. I think it's inherently a challenge, which is what makes it one of the wild cards on the track or on the schedule, is the fact that it is challenging and all of that. But I think if you're going to put together a good product for the race fan, you can't have the drivers holding back for most of the race. And that it's going to be a good one. So I understand Kyle's frustration. I understand the frustration of the drivers that are kind of frustrated with the next-gen car. But keep in mind that they're part of the problem at the same time that they're also part of the solution. They're consciously making this decision to run at 60% throttle for all of the reasons that we've talked about. And not really going for it until the end of the race. It was a shame that Micah McDowell, trying to make that block, ended up in, 31st place instead of winning the race. I don't know what the answer is. I think that it's always been a problem for super speedway racing. We either watch them go around the track at single file most of the time, or they're all going side by side at, you know, really fast, and not really passing one another either. So I really don't know what the answer is. I wish there was a solution, but super speedway racing I think the reason they run at 60% throttle is they know that they don't want to get caught up in that big wreck. And so they're trying to take it easy so that they don't. In order to finish the race, you got to be there. And then that big wreck ends up happening at the end of the race. So it's a challenge for sure. And I don't know what the answer is, and I haven't really heard anybody come up with what the answer is for super speedway racing. You can almost miss most of the race and come in the last 20 laps and see everything that happened. So that doesn't really make it a fun product either. So there's got to be an answer. I just don't know what it is. Andy, do you have any solutions?
Well, yeah, the solution would be to make them run 100% throttle for the entire race, but then you're in a bad spot of regulating throttle trace, and I'd hate to see that because, you know, I don't think more regulation is a good thing. So, but that would probably be the only thing I can come up with, which isn't a good idea. So so the short answer is no, I don't have anything valid to come up with. But kind of already been touched on here, but you know, if you didn't really know what the teams were up to, you know, you didn't know that they were saving fuel, and you didn't know that they were trying to hit a certain window to pit. I mean, they were 2 and 3 wide for most of the day, so I thought that the visual appearance of the race looked like a standard Talladega race that we've seen since, you know, for years. So I didn't think that the race looked, you know, visibly to the point where they were blatantly trying to save fuel like we've seen with single file racing a lot in the past. I thought that, generally speaking, it looked like a decent race, but you know, but yeah, listening to the in-car stuff, I mean, you know, teams were not only trying to save fuel, but they were monitoring what everyone else is doing. And, you know, to that point, I would almost like to see the abolishment of the SMT, because that has really been, I think, the catalyst for everyone knowing what everyone else is doing, you know, in terms of throttle and brakes and this and that. And, it, you know, I feel like if you got rid of that, you could make it more of an old school situation where, yeah, teams could, you know, feed ideas off of their teammates and try to develop strategies to work together. But if you don't know what everyone's doing with the data, you know, it puts it more back in the crew chief's hands and the driver's hands. Maybe that's the answer, honestly, because if we don't know what everyone else is doing, then there's no way everyone can replicate that. So to me, that's probably the only real good solution that I can think of here on the fly.
Okay, well, that sounds good. All right, I think that's it for that topic. But our last topic has to do with a possible owner shakeup in 2025, and Stern is reporting that Kroger could be on the move to another team next season, and that's part of a possible ownership shakeup at JTG Racing. That's always hard for me to say for some reason. So some more silly season type of talk. What are your thoughts about that, Jay?
Well, this is one that I hadn't seen or heard anything on this, and I mean, we always know that sponsorship is a big key, and teams making changes. We've seen that in the past year or two of some big ones moving, Anheuser-Busch, and then Smithfield going away, and what it did to Stuart Haas Racing. For JTG Daugherty, this would be huge because that is kind of their primary sponsor, and I know there's a lot more to it. As they had formed a company or program where they were actually helping Toyota's find sponsorship. And I know that ties into this article with Joe Gibbs Racing. We don't have an indication of where Kroger may go if they leave, but it turns out it could be real detrimental to their own team, especially as a single car team. And it may lead to that they become an associate of Joe Gibbs Racing, and that's speculation then. If it comes down to it with that partnership of that, a lot of things, interesting things, and I say interesting. One aspect, it's good, you know, as you've seen with Anheuser-Busch moving to a new driver, new campaign with Ross Chastain, good for them, but it also then hurts the team that lost it. There's always that good side, bad side. Somebody wins the race, somebody loses it. And I really would hate to see it affect JTG Daugherty. I know they're not a top-tier team, but they do have good runs and have been in the playoffs a couple of times. So I hate to see that go away if it were to affect them to that level.
Okay. Andy, your thoughts?
You kind of get the feeling that the NASCAR Cup Series ownership landscape is set to make some significant changes. So this rumor came as a surprise to me. I didn't think that there would be any changes with JTG Daugherty Racing. You know, obviously we've seen the rumors with Stuart Haas Racing. It seems like their future is very much open to debate as far as where they're headed down the road. You know, and it could be that the demand for charters right now from either existing teams wanting to expand or perhaps new ownership has put some of these teams in a position where it's too good to not sell a charter And that may be the case here for JTG Doherty Racing. This is just, you know, me thinking out loud, so none of this is confirmed. But, you know, if you're in a position where you want to make some money and maybe, you know, be done with ownership, and in the case of JTG Doherty Racing, they've been around for quite a while. They owned Busch teams back in the, I think, going back to the 90s. So they're not new to NASCAR ownership. They've been doing this a long time. Eventually, they either have to sell or transition ownership to somebody else as they move on with life and perhaps either focus on other things or retirement, whatever the case may be. So I think, honestly, you know, if for some reason things do change with this team as far as either their ownership or them selling, I think that, you know, I always say this on here, that racing is a business, and at some point you have to look at the financial gain from selling a charter and say, maybe now's the time for me to sell my operation. So, if they do wind up doing that, you know, you have to think that maybe it's because it was financially worth it for them to make that change at this particular time. And that may not be just the case for JTG Doherty Racing. That could also be the case as to why potentially Stewart Haas Racing makes changes down the road, and it may not end there. It may be the case with other teams too. So, but you kind of just get that vibe that we're in for potentially a pretty big silly season for 2025. And although nothing has been announced or talked about yet, it seems like the rumors are there. And I think that, you know, we could be in for some significant changes going into next season.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it, doesn't it, Andy? With what we've been talking about with Stewart Haas Racing and now with this sponsorship move. I just posted some additional information that I saw over here on J-Skis as well. And the rumor mill is saying that the Kroger sponsorship could be moving to Joe Gibbs Racing next season. It says the owner, Tad Gesticker, also runs the Brand Activation Maximizer Agency, and in 2022 it started working with Joe Gibbs Racing. The arrangement at the time raised eyebrows in the NASCAR garage because it involved the owner of his Chevrolet-aligned team helping to sell sponsorship for a Toyota-aligned outfit. So they're saying that it could be they've identified that Joe Gibbs Racing is a possible destination for Kroger in the 2025 move that could bring Gesticker along with it. So could be that JTG Doherty might end up, like you say, selling their charters, and then that owner moving over to another organization, according to this particular article. Nothing's been announced. This article came from the Sports Business Journal. Nothing is official. This is all speculation that's been put out there based on what's being said within the industry as part of the rumor mill, if you will. But I find it interesting that they've made that identification already and that connection between the team owner and Joe Gibbs Racing, and that they've already been working with that organization. So it's going to be interesting to see what actually does happen, but sponsorship is the key here, and the cost of doing business within the charters. I think you see these smaller teams are teams that are having financial issues right now. You're right, Andy. I think this is just signaling that there's going to be some major changes coming into the 2025 season. Jay, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's two interesting scenarios that kind of I see developing there. If this were to happen, as you said, it's speculation. One would be JTG Doherty going to a Toyota and being an alliance team with Joe Gibbs Racing and kind of pairing or sharing sponsorships. We've seen that in the past, though, going all the way back to Front Row Motorsports with them. But we've also seen that not work, as the cost of it was just too much. I'm trying to think of the other team. Levine Family Racing, I think, was the other one.
Yeah,
That was a single car, two car team. Who is the owner of the Geico? can't think of the owner's name on that one. The number 13 Geico machine. That was another
Jermaine
one
Racing.
That eventually.
Jermaine Racing.
Say it again.
Thank you.
There we go. Jermaine Racing. Thank you. That the Alliance thing just got to be too costly, so they couldn't do that either. Now you have the possibility of, and I'm just going to throw a real wild one out there, Dale Earnhardt Jr. coming in as, say, a partner with that team, because then you have a bigger name, just like we saw with Michael Jordan in 2311, that can bring in some sponsorship and maybe help with that. But then it would obviously, I imagine, stay with the Chevy team. We saw it with Trackhouse Racing and bringing in Pitbull, bringing sponsorship and viewership from another platform. So that's one aspect to it. The other is, Andy was alluding to, of if they decide to sell out and get out of the racing side, maybe they just focus on the marketing side of it. They sell the charter for the team, but stay involved in working on the marketing side of it if that's where their forte is. So that could be an interesting aspect of it as well. You know, and I remember when this came about back in 2022 when they first announced it, it did seem kind of odd that there was somebody working with both a Chevrolet team and a Toyota team in trying to find sponsorship, because every one of them searching for their own and need as much as they can get, that you'd be doing so for multiple battling teams and manufacturers especially. You don't see that very often. But I think this is where there's a lot of things I know tie into the TV rights deal when it comes to NASCAR and the amount the owners are going to get. That's obviously been, still is a huge discussion. But the model itself, I mean, and I think that's where it really comes down to, and that kind of ties back into the previous one of what can be done to work on the fuel mileage. If you go about changing the fuel tank size, this car was designed to be cost-effective and allow new teams to come in and not have to invest as much or not be as behind these other teams that have the money and the sponsors. But when you talk about making a change to something like that, you're talking about then more money because you got to change over all the cars. So I don't know the answer. I'm with Andy. I'm like, I don't know that I have the answer.
Okay, Andy, your follow-up?
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add, I don't think, for this one.
Yeah, I kind of don't really either. I mean, it's one of those things that they're speculating. You know, Sports Business Journal and Adam Stern usually know what's going on and usually is pretty reliable that these things are potentially happening. But, again, we don't know what the final result of that is probably going to be. So until we know that, it's hard to kind of speculate on what all of that means. But, you know, time always tells the rest of the story. So I guess that's what we have to wait for. Okay. Andy, did you have anything else on your mind that you wanted to talk about here tonight?
Yeah, this one isn't necessarily written down in our Hot Topic segment, but kind of wanted to get both of your thoughts on the state of blocking at super speedway races. You know, specifically, you know, we saw aggressive blocking by McDowell to basically wreck the whole field coming to the checkered flag. So has blocking gotten out of hand, or is this just the way it is with super speedway racing? That would be my question to the both of you.
Okay. Jay, your thoughts.
Well, tonight it's Andy that read my mind. That was one. I was trying to find an article to even start that conversation, how to put it up. My mind, unfortunately, kept going to, I believe it is Formula One. I don't know if that is 100% accurate, but they have a rule as far as blocking. You can make one move to block, but not a second one, because that's really what we saw when it came to what happened at the end of the cup race with at Talladega was – McDowell made a block to the high side. Keselowski was prepared for it, cut back down to the bottom, and he made a dramatic move from top to bottom all the way down. And I don't even think that, and I've watched a couple of replays, whether or not Brad hit him or it's just when he got to the bottom of the track and tried to stay straight and get back in line, his car bobbled, and thus then the pack got into him, starting with Brad Keselowski. You know, watching social media, which I don't necessarily enjoy, but, you know, whether they were putting the blame on Brad. Oh, Brad doing his thing on super speedways and being overly aggressive. That certainly was not the case. As we saw that the entire race, Brad was the one tucked to Michael McDowell. And when they did on Race Hub today, they do, can't remember what they call it, but break it down real slow and take it apart piece by piece. Brad did an excellent job. He pushed Michael McDowell out front far enough where he also was clear of the Toyotas that were on the top line, then backed off so that Gregson would catch him, and the two of them were connected, and they had the run to pass Michael McDowell. So Brad did an awesome job of setting that up to where he was in position to make the pass, which he did. Essentially did. Again, it was Michael McDowell coming back across the track. And I like Michael McDowell. I would have had no problem seeing him win, but that was a bad, bad move on his part.
Yeah, blocking. I like the idea of instituting you can do one block and that's it. How they would officiate that is another story, but I think that blocking has kind of gotten out of hand, and I think it's become accepted amongst the drivers that that's going to happen. A lot of these drivers feel like they have to protect their position, that they worked hard to get there, and they want to protect their place. But we see too many of these big wrecks happening at the end of the race, and a lot of times it's because of blocking. One of the famous ones that I recall all the time is when Tony Stewart was complaining about Joey Logano, I think it was, blocking, and yet he did a block a few weeks later that took out half of the field, and literally it was like 25 cars involved in that block that Tony Stewart did. And that's the kind of, I don't want to say, I just read something that said tragedy, and tragedy's on my mind, but that's kind of the fallacy, I guess, of super speedway racing, or the disappointment of speedway racing, is that super speedway racing is that these drivers are doing everything they possibly can to win a race, and it's gotten to the point that there's not a lot of respect for the driver for each other on the track. I think there's probably more than what we see as far as respect for the other drivers, but sometimes it just doesn't seem like it when we're seeing each the blocking against each other, and it's so easy for one little bobble, like you said, Andy, one little bobble can make such a huge difference in what happens on the track, because these guys are racing so fast and so close together. It does make me kind of feel that maybe blocking's not a good idea on super speedways, because it can take out so many cars. And if NASCAR were to restrict it to just one block and that's it, I'd be all for it. Because I don't necessarily like to see those big pileups on the racetrack. But it'll be interesting. I don't know that NASCAR is going to do anything as it relates to blocking, because I think it's going to be too hard to officiate. I do think it's a little bit out of hand, and it's unfortunate that so many cars get caught up in something that's not of their own doing when a blocking mishap happens. Andy, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. This race isn't the first time that we've seen this. I mean, I think we can go back to, 2009, when Edwards got sent up into the grandstands. You know,
yeah.
So that was a case of a late block in which he turned himself off the nose of Keselowski, who held his line, and you know, so. I guess the point is that blocking at super speedways, you know, has been around for a long time, and this certainly wasn't some isolated or new thing. But I thought that the move at the end of the race was really aggressive, amongst the most aggressive that I've seen. But I don't fault Michael McDowell, because if he doesn't block, you know, he gets passed for the win. Now, in that case, mm-hmm. he probably would have finished second or third, and everyone probably would have made it across the start-finish line with a clean race car or close to it. But, you know, you gotta try to win the race. And in his case, being the leader on the last lap is a bit of a precarious position, because you know that the second and third place cars are going to try to make a move for the win, just as you already mentioned with Keselowski and Gregson lining up to try to pass him. Keselowski made what probably should have been the winning move of the race, and, you know, it just didn't work out because of the aggressive blocking. It's unfortunately become necessary, you know, because if you don't block, you're going to get passed and you're not going to win. So it's an unfortunate catch-22. I think that, you know, it's become necessary to protect your ground and maintain your position, but at the same time, it's been probably the number one cause for all these super speedway wrecks that we've seen recently. So I don't know how you police it. I think the idea that Jay brought up of, you know, maybe having some kind of a, you know, you can make one block but not two, might not be a bad idea, but then trying to go about policing that is a whole different can of worms that I don't know if we want to see that type of regulation or not. I don't know, but it does seem to be getting kind of out of hand, so I don't know how you tone that down a bit, but it definitely was the cause of that big wreck on the last lap.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, I was just saying that I know another series does it. I'm not a big fan of it. And the whole monitoring it, policing it, you know, Andy brought up the Carl Edwards, Brad Keselowski. That was a matter of the double yellow line. You can't go below the double yellow line. And we had seen it the year prior with Regan Smith and Tony Stewart, as a matter of fact, I think actually, where Regan went below the line, felt like, hey, NASCAR will make the call that I was pushed down there and went to avoid the wreck. They didn't. Thus, Brad Keselowski said, I'm staying in the throttle. I'm not going below the line. Carl came across his nose, and the chips fall where they may. I think the biggest thing is the drivers have to do this. I mean, it's one of those that was completely in their hands as far as that. You know, it's same with the bump drafting. I know in the Xfinity series, they can't lock bumpers and push as hard as in the Cup Series. So, I mean, that was one thing NASCAR tried to do, but they still got to at least bump draft to an extent. As Andy was saying, it's become a necessity or whatever. But with the blocking, it's a whole lot bigger risk when it comes to that. Because you especially when your spotters are at some points a mile and a half away trying to see it, you don't have the clear vision. And again, I like Michael McDowell. I would have been happy to see him win. That team has been progressing, but that was just a very bad. Like I said, he went up, made the block to the top. Brad got by him to the inside to come from the top to the bottom. It was a bold, bold move, and it clearly did not work. So I would think the drivers would say, hey, we can't be doing this anymore. It's one of those of, and I know we don't want to go full political, but the 2020 election. At some point, you got to admit you're beat. You know, Michael had the lead. They knew the run was coming. He tried to block it. Brad got by him. You know, if a car is to your inside quarter panel or halfway up the car, they got you. I mean, you can't just cut down and chop them off. You got beat. I mean, there's nothing more you can do other than what he did and make a wild, bold move and wreck the field. And that's where I think that the drivers just need to then at that point be like, hey, I lost this one. You know, can I make the move earlier, differently, or only go halfway up to the top and then come back down myself, leave him up there by himself, and I could go down and get the draft in front of Noah Gregson. You know, that was an option. Make a half block, if you will, and then get back in the line that has the momentum in the cars. So I think it has to come from the drivers themselves and just say, hey, this isn't worth the risk.
Yeah, you're right that it has to start with the drivers. But they're so darn competitive. It's And when you're in the heat of the moment and going after that victory, I think it's been drilled into their head that they've got to do everything they possibly can to get that win, and so blocking becomes part of it. But at some point, yeah, you would think that collectively they would realize this might not be the best idea to be blocking like this, and maybe we should limit ourselves. But time after time, we know that drivers have to be saved from themselves by having a rule implemented. Without the rule, they're not going to self-police themselves. It just doesn't seem to happen. It goes back to the 100% rule. You know, they're not they're racing at 60% throttle. but how does NASCAR officiate that? And we don't want NASCAR regulating so many different things as part of the race either. So it starts with the drivers. They have to collectively make that decision. I just don't know that if they're really capable of doing it. Andy, you get the last word here.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add other than, you know, I do think it's in the driver's hands, like you said, and somehow they have to figure out, you know, what the right answer is, because I don't know, I guess if I'm a driver, you know, and I constantly get wrecked because of somebody else's aggressive blocking, that's frustrating, right? So, you know, eventually they have to figure out that, well, if I don't like being wrecked because of an aggressive block, then maybe I shouldn't be the one throwing aggressive blocks. Jay brings up a valid point. You know, you can only block so many times before, in this case, Kozlowski was there, you know, and he was set to make the pass to win the race. And, you know, in this case, it probably would have been a lot better day to just run second, you know, and accept defeat than tear up himself and 15 other cars. So, and I'm not singling out McDowell here. I mean, this has been a theme in the trucks, ARCA, Xfinity Cup, I mean, over the last number of years. This isn't isolated to just yesterday, but it was certainly exemplified yesterday. And you know, I think it has gotten to a point where, you know, they need to, you know, maybe think about the repercussions of making those aggressive moves. But again, to your point, Sharon, I think when you're trying to win a race, you've got such tunnel vision that you're only thinking about one thing, and that's checkers or wreckers, I guess. But I don't know. I guess the bottom line for me is hopefully we see it toned down a bit moving forward.
We can always hope, right, Andy?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Jay, did you have any other topics you had on your mind that you want to talk about?
I kind of do, and I know this might take us a little bit into the overtime. We didn't have any other major ones on the list, but an interesting one that it got talked about a little bit at Texas and got carried over to Talladega, and Dover is now using it for the next race. Their promotion for the race is their scoring pylon, the at-track scoring pylon, getting fired up and ready to be turned on, because Talladega and Texas have taken theirs away, and there was a lot of lashback from fans and drivers, actually, on that, of tracks taking away the big scoring pylons.
Yeah, I wonder why they're doing that. Andy, do you know?
I don't know, and I find it very perplexing, actually, why they're doing it. I think the first I heard of it was this past weekend at Talladega. I don't know. For me personally, when I go to the racetrack, I've found them to be useful. Usually I'm trying not to look at my phone for the running order. I'm trying to watch the race in front of me. So a quick glance at the scoring pylon is useful as far as, you know, verifying the running order throughout the race. So I've found it to be a useful resource. So it's a bit of a mystery to me why they're going away. I believe running orders are now being posted on big screen TVs if the tracks have them, and I think most do at this point. So it's not like you can't see the running order, but, you know, certainly I think perhaps even more useful for the teams themselves, you know, especially during qualifying, you know, a quick glance at the pylon to see if you, you know, are P1 or 2, whatever the case may be, is a lot more useful than – than trying to look at a TV screen or whatever. So I don't know. It's a bit of a mystery to me. I don't know what the rationale behind it is, but I've found them to be useful, and I don't really know why they're going away.
Okay. I agree. I know it doesn't make sense to me why they would go away, except for exactly what you brought up, Andy, and that is that they have the TV screens now available, and it might just be a matter of retraining ourselves to look at the TV versus the scoring pylon. But I got to tell you, trying to catch that information on the TV, I think, is going to be really, really hard. And I think the drivers are used to looking at that scoring pylon, too, as they're driving and around the track or during a caution or whatever and checking to see, you know, what their position is and who are the drivers that are around them. And I know when I'm at the track, I look at the scoring pylon a lot to catch that information as well. So it's a mystery to me why they would take it down. I suppose there's some cost savings involved by taking it down. I think that's probably run via electricity. I don't think it's solar powered. I don't know. But I wish they wouldn't take them down. I would hate to see that happening as a trend across all of the tracks if they were to take the scoring pylon down. I think it's kind of a part of the racing environment, if you will, having that scoring pylon to look at. So to me, it would be a shame if they decide to do that at all the tracks. And I'm glad to hear that Dover is gearing theirs up and getting ready to turn it on for the racing this weekend. Jay, what are your thoughts?
Well, I can add a little bit to what you both said. I mean, there's factors to both sides. It was drivers, and I don't remember specifically the ones that talked about it, so I don't want to quote anybody, but there were several drivers.
Oh, Jay, I got to interrupt
you.
Go
ahead.
Sorry.
Yep.
Okay. We're at that part of the show that we're going to go off the air at exactly 10:30 p.m. Eastern time. For those of you that are tuning in for the first time, we make this announcement to let you know that we are going to continue our conversation, and we'll record that part of the conversation, and it will be available via our podcast as bonus overtime material. So we tell you that just so that you know how you can listen to it. What I'm going to do is go out on Twitter as well as Facebook to let you know that the podcast is available. And at that point, you can go to the player at your convenience that's available over at fanforracing.com. Just fast forward to that two-hour mark whenever you're ready to hear the rest of our conversation. So, again, that way nobody's caught off guard or taken by surprise and not know how you can hear the rest of that conversation. I apologize for the interruption, Jay. Go ahead and finish your thought.
I say some drivers did comment on it that they used it, as Andy pointed out, of a quick glance up there, and can't do the same off of the big screens that they now have. And I say this initially got brought up as Texas, but really built momentum when it came to Talladega's. And from the fan side as well, as Andy pointed out, you're trying to stay off your phone. Some fans are, I'll put it that way. That's the whole point. You want to be at the track. If you want to watch the race and everything else on your phone or TV, you'd stay at home. That's part of the at-track experience. And some of the pylons, I don't know if they'd get labeled as iconic, but I think of some of the cool ones, Pocono, Memphis Motorsports Park, obviously the one at the Brickyard Indianapolis Speedway, are part of the heritage and history of the track. Now, I will say this, having read of, as it became a bigger deal at Talladega, theirs was an older one. They said that the cost of repairing it and some of the parts for it couldn't even be found anymore. So that was the reason for theirs. I believe Texas was, they said, we invested all this money in Big Hoss, and so we have it, but it's not the same effect as what it has, both from the fans, as Sharon mentioned, from the fans who utilize it. You can see it from anywhere in the track. There were a lot that from the infield, as you mentioned, the drivers as well as the crews that can just quick glance. They don't have to be, again, focused in on their computer screen or TV or whatever it is, that it's just that quick glance up. So I do hope, like you said, Sharon, this isn't a trend. And I just, like I said, tonight happened to notice that was Dover's advertisement for their upcoming race, was that their pylon was up and getting ready to fire up. So I thought that was kind of interesting. They were using that as, hey, we got ours going.
Okay, Andy?
Yeah, hopefully this isn't a trend that we see elsewhere. Hopefully this is just perhaps an isolated couple of instances. Thankfully, Dover has theirs because they promoted it today, which I thought was good. So I don't know. I find the pylons to be useful, and you know, hopefully they remain at least at some racetracks.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything that I can add to what we've already said, and I can't think of anything, Jay, so I'll let you go ahead and wrap it up.
Well, it's one of those of, again, you know, technology is obviously a part of this day and age, but I think they can find a combination. And I think of Cedar Lake Speedway, a dirt track in Wisconsin that I grew up going to, having gone back here in the last couple of years, the evolution that it made there. They got two big scoreboards, if you will, with LED screens, but then they still had the video package on one side and the running order over on the left side of it. So I think that you can find a way to combine the two, not take one or the other away. I think that there's a way to find that combination. So I think it's an evolution, and maybe it's one of those things that as a whole NASCAR didn't think was important, but you've heard from drivers and fans that it really is. So I hopefully they look at that of if they have to, in the case of Talladega, like I said, the claim was that they couldn't, some of the parts couldn't even be found for that one anymore to replace it or repair it and update it. You got to build a new one and do it in conjunction with the bigger LED screens or something to that effect. So I think there is a way to satisfy both, and I don't have to pay for it.
Good.
So either way.
Yeah. It's kind of like when I hit the deer, I guess, and it totaled my car. The reason the car got totaled is because it was a 2007 Ford 500, and it was still running really, really good. But because they don't make that anymore, and they can't get parts for it. So it could not be repaired, and it had to be totaled, which is really a shame. So I guess I can understand that to a certain degree, but doggone it. Andy, is there anything else on your list?
No, I don't have anything else, I don't believe.
How about you, Jay?
No, those were the couple of Andy read my mind as well as you did, sure, and then when we were talking about both of those. So everything got pulled out of my brain.
Okay, well then I guess we're ready to call it a night. Let's go ahead and do our roundtable then. Jay, why don't you start us off with that?
You can follow me on Facebook, Michael Hoosman, MoparMJ8, on Twitter and Instagram. Again, look forward to another good weekend. Dover, I think some of the things that are happening in NASCAR are exciting. As far as the races we've seen, I know Talladega, we got through the weekend, didn't have any major upsets, if you will, but came really close. So I think there's some things happening there that we may see a shift in dynamics, as well as ownership. I know we got to wait a little bit longer for that, but some big things going into next year as well, which already got me excited about that. So hope to be on again next week. I know I won't be this week on Thursday, but hopefully we'll be on Monday night.
Okay. By the way, speaking of Thursdays, we're what now? 10 races in? Only 2 more weeks?
Yeah, we'll talk about that. I believe the graduation that they're doing is May 2nd, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
May 2nd? Okay. I knew it was coming up on that time, and I wasn't quite sure. I wanted to let Brian know, too. Okay, Andy, let's do your sign-off.
PB 14 fan on X, and good to be on. I know it's been very infrequent the last few weeks, so good that my schedule finally allowed me to be on tonight. And due to work, Thursday is pending, or I should say up in the air, but hopefully can be on. And if not, certainly looking forward to Dover this weekend.
Okay. Well, it's always good when Andy can be on the Hot Topic Sound Off conversation, as well as you, Jay. So I'm glad both of you are available tonight. I am Fan for Racing Site on Twitter, Fan for Racing Blog and Radio on Facebook. And again, I'll go out there to let you know when our show is over and the bonus overtime material is available. Definitely looking forward to once again doing the preview show of Dover for this coming weekend. Both the Arca Menards Series and the East will have their race out at Dover this weekend, as well as the Xfinity and the Cup Series. So there's a lot to look forward to there. And we will preview all of those races on Thursday with Brian Eberle. And I certainly hope you can, guys can, well, Jay, I know you can't, but Andy, it'd sure be great if you can make it onto our Hot Topic Sound Off discussion on Thursday. And we'll look forward to talking about Dover and the scoring pylon that's going to be there. We also have... earlier in the show today, we did play the interview, the media interview from Ryan Sieg. He won the Dash for Cash bonus this weekend at Talladega. They'll be racing for the Dash for Cash. It'll be Ryan Sieg, Jesse Love, Anthony Alfredo, and all of a sudden I can't remember the other driver. There's a fourth driver here. And that is, Riley Herbst will be the other driver that will be racing for that Dash for Cash bonus at Dover. So always enjoy that program, and it's always fun. When you see a driver like Ryan Sieg, one of the lower-funded teams, I think he said there's like 14 employees in their entire organization. So for them to win that Dash for Cash bonus was a really big deal. So if you want to listen to his interview, that is available earlier on our review part of the show. And I believe we played it about 50 minutes into the show if you want to queue it up to hear that interview. So with that, I think we're ready to call it a night to both Jay and Andy for being here and Sal Segala for the review part of the show, and we'll look forward to being back again on Thursday.
All right. Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Good night, everybody.